Hi. On the 5th and 6th of June 2024, I'll be speaking at the largest AI event in Asia, Super AI in Singapore, at the iconic Marina Bay Sands. Alongside brilliant minds like Edward Snowden, Benedict Devon, and Balaji Srinivasan, I'll be on a stage exploring the extraordinary potential of AI and the profound change it represents, not just for financial markets, but also for the world as we know it. With over 5,000 attendees and over 150 side events, Singapore will become a vibrant hub for a full week from the 3rd and 9th of June. Visit superai.com to register and join me with 20% off tickets using the code REALVISION. Use the link in the description and I'll see you there. It's going to be incredible.
Is this a Goldilocks market? Boy, that's a hot topic for debate. Welcome to Real Vision Daily Briefing. It's Friday, March 8, 2024. I'm Ash Bennington, joined today by Dr. Komal Sri Kumar, president of Sri Kumar Global Strategies. Sri, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Ash. Good to be back with you.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have you with us, sharing your wisdom, but especially today, boy, is this a macro moment that we're having right here? I set it up at the top of the show. Lots happening in markets. Lots of chatter about the Fed chair's testimony yesterday. We got some new numbers out on the NFP data today. Sri, where do you begin to get your head around these markets?
I think where you start with, as you quite correctly said, Ash, you start with the Fed. You start with Powell and his statements. And the big news of this week, it's a fact, in addition to the jobs report that we got today, the difference between the presentations that Powell made to the House committee on Wednesday and what he told the Senate committee yesterday, the difference is that he decided probably that his first speech was not sufficiently positive for the markets. So yesterday he added on that we are not very far at all from cutting interest rates. That's a new addition, which didn't exist before. And I think the change now is because he's against switching. He wants to make sure he's recognized as taking the investors' interests into account. But what bothers me here is that that is not his mandate. His mandate is inflation. His mandate is employment. And a Fed chairman, however ambitious you may be, you need to stick with your two goals in the mandate, not create one of your own.
Well, this has been one of the hot topics now in terms of what exactly is the Fed's mandate. Is it supporting equity markets? Is it, you know, combating climate change, all these other causes? Lots of folks are very concerned about that. What do you think? How are they going to steer a middle course between the Scylla and Charybdis of the dual mandate, which in itself, forget everything else, is a real challenge?
You're absolutely correct. The twin mandate itself, in some ways, is illogical. We say in logic, when you have one instrument, that one instrument can be used toward one target. You can't have one instrument, namely interest rate changes, and you hope to have an attack on two goals with respect to employment and with respect to prices. But let's set that aside and say somehow we accept it. But the Fed is being pushed, as we saw in Congress in the last couple of days, by Democrats and Republicans who both want him to do what they want him to do from an electoral point of view. That is adding a new dimension to the whole part. We also have a problem in that Fed chairmen typically come from the private sector. This one in particular doesn't come from academia. He comes from the private equity area. He will probably go back there after his chairmanship ends. And so there is an innate bias in terms of how they act with respect to policy. That is in addition to the twin mandates that they have.
Well, I suspect Chair Powell is going to do pretty well after he leaves this appointment. But I wanted to touch on the new news here, which is the non-farm payroll data out today. It's kind of a confusing, something of a mixed report, I guess you could say. The rate of wage growth is slowing. The unemployment rate jumped from 3.7 prior month to 3.9% in February. And net increases in non-farm payrolls came in at 275,000, above consensus, above the top of the consensus range, which was quite wide, I must say, 95,000, 260,000. And above prior month revised, which was revised to 229,000 for January, revised down from 353. Boy, I mean, the data just is all over the place. I don't know, can't make heads or tails of it.
You're absolutely correct. Let me put it to you this way. If I were Fed chairman, and if I was speaking yesterday to the Senate committee as Powell did, and let's say that I have some prior inkling on what numbers are going to come out today because I'm the Fed chairman, and I get some preview on what the information is going to come out like. If that were the case, I would be a lot more cautious in terms of how I'm going to steer the ship. I will not provide forward guidance for fear that may turn into forward confusion because, again, as we know, Powell has had the situation before when he spoke about transitory inflation and then inflation took off as he doubled the balance sheet and cut the interest rates down to zero. Once you have done that, and in December, he made the error again in suggesting that rate cuts are coming quickly, by the January 31st press conference, he had to reverse himself. Given the history, given the record, and as you said, Ash, the cloudiness of yesterday's numbers, employment being high, but the past numbers being revised down, wage increase month on month only 0.1%. However, year on year is still running at an unacceptable 4.3%, which means inflation is being fed by wage growth. When I have all of this information, if I were Fed chairman, I would be more cautious, which again was not the case with Jerome Powell. And that to me is very puzzling indeed.
Well, it's almost like he's just in an impossible position, right? Because you know he made this statement. This is, I believe, from the House testimony. Reducing policy restraint too soon or too much could ultimately require even tighter policy to get inflation to 2%. True. At the same time, reducing policy restraint too late or too little could unduly weaken economic activity and employment. So you get criticized when you say, make a definitive statement. You get criticized, the Harry Truman clip about a one-handed economist. I mean, it seems like it's a no-win situation, probably as you point out, Sri, because he's battling both sides of the dual mandate with tools that you can either optimize for A or B, but not A and B.
Right. He is in an impossible situation. And when you find yourself in a difficult position like that, it pays to be cautious. That's why I say that it is not helpful to investors that he has been swinging to the fences 1 month, and then he's pulling back the next month and swinging for the fences again the following month. So we have had this switch take place. It is actually bewildering after if you put December through yesterday's speeches all together and you say, what is the Fed view? The answer is, no idea whatsoever what they really think. Add to this, Ash, what is happening with the other statements. December 13th, he came through being very dovish. The very next day, John Williams, who is the president of the New York Fed, often thought to be the second most powerful official at the Fed, he came out and said, oh no, interest rates are not going to be cut very quickly. Wait a second, the chairman said yesterday they are going to be cut very quickly. You today don't think it's going to be cut quickly. Who is correct and what are you thinking about? So more officials came forth in opposing him. So the Fed is essentially not helping in terms of confusing the picture repeatedly with statements which don't make sense with each other.
We're going to take a quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Join over 5,000 attendees for the largest AI event in Asia at Super AI Singapore, June 5th and 6th, 2024. Raoul Pal, Benedict Evans, Balaji Srinivasan, Edward Snowden, and over 150 others will join the industry's most influential to explore and unveil the next wave of transformative AI technologies. Singapore will become a vibrant AI hub for a week from June 3rd through June 9th, with over 150 side events that will make for unparalleled networking opportunities. Visit www.realvision.com/superai for 20% off tickets with the code REALVISION or click below.
Hey there. Thanks for tuning into the Real Vision Podcast Network. After the holidays, we could all use a little extra cash in our pockets. After all the gift-giving and festivities, we still need to buy the everyday things we need. make sure you're getting cash back on all of your everyday purchases with Ibotta. Ibotta is a free app that gives you the most cash back every time you shop on hundreds of items from groceries to beauty supplies to toys. So make sure you're beating inflation no matter what you're purchasing. The average Ibotta user earns $145 per year. That could cover the entire cost of a shopping trip, buy that flight you've been eyeing up, or that music or sporting event you're dying to go to. Other apps give you points that don't amount to much. With Ibotta, just add your offers in the app, upload your receipt, and get real cash that you can cash out to your bank account, PayPal, or gift cards. Join more than 50 million savers and earn cash back every time you shop from over 2,700 brands and retailers, including Lowe's, Macy's, Sephora, Best Buy, and more. Right now, Ibotta is offering our listeners $5 just for trying Ibotta by using the code REALVISION when you register. Just go to the App Store or Google Play Store and download the free Ibotta app to start earning cash back and use code REALVISION, all one word, when you register. That's Ibotta in the Google Play or App Store and use code REALVISION.
All right, Sri, talking about impossible situations, I'm going to ask you two impossible questions. Based on the data, one, where do you see the balance of risk? In which direction are you more so concerned? And then I've got to ask you the reaction function question, which is like this Keynesian beauty contest situation, which we find ourselves in, which is, in which direction do you think the Fed is more concerned going into, obviously, this election season?
I'm going to take that as three questions, Ash, and let me tell you why. First, what is going to happen to the Fed? Set aside the election for a moment. How is the Fed going to act without taking into account elections? They think inflation is going to come down by itself with the weight of all the past rate increases. I do not believe so. And the reason is, take a look at the Fed's balance sheet. It is still 75 to 80% larger today than at the start of COVID. This is after so much of QT or quantitative tightening that has already taken place. So that's one reason to worry about it. Second, there are a lot of geopolitical uncertainties with respect to oil and the Middle East, food prices and the Ukraine conflict, transportation problems connected with the Red Sea shootings and the possible problems in the Taiwan Strait. When all of these are concerned, inflation is an upward side. There is a lot of concern as to which way it can go. Second, what is the reaction function here? I don't think inflation is going to come down automatically by itself. On the other hand, there is going to be a cut in the interest rates, I believe. And I think quantitative tightening before the end of this year is going to be reversed, and we are going to have quantitative easing on our hands. Do they both happen because inflation has come to 2% or lower? No. I think the reason why the changes are taking place is because there are shocks to the system in terms of what we see happening on the banking side. Before the banking crisis of last March, I had written in my public notes that there is going to be a credit event. It turned out to be the regional banking crisis. Since then, I've been saying there is going to be one more credit event. And that is turning out to be increasingly the worsening problems on the commercial real estate side and how that is enveloping a whole lot of different banks. Another issue, the consumer is overextended. He or she, despite the high wages that they have got, are spending even more than that, and credit card debt, even for the largest banks, are increasing. When you put it all together, I think something is going to break in the system, causing the Fed to abruptly reverse and then cut rates and introduce quantitative easing. Think September 2008, think March 2003, when both cases, when the policies in 2023 again, the reversal took place with respect to quantitative tightening, which was stopped last March, and we introduced quantitative easing. So those are the two things. Now bring the election in, you have an additional complication. And I think this is where I keep repeating that the Fed likes to say that they don't even know don't talk about elections. They never come up in their discussions. Well, if you believe that I'm going to make myself a very rich man, I'm going to sell you a lot of bridges to a whole lot of different people, because it looks like a very gullible public that would think that the Fed does not have political intentions. The Fed is very political. And let me tell you why. Again, base it on factual reasons. A president is elected every 4 years. The chairman of the Federal Reserve is also nominated for 4 years, but his or her term does not end with that of the president. It typically ends about a year and a half after the new president comes in. And in this case, because Powell was late in getting confirmed, his term ends in March of 2026. So the president would have been in office, new president, would have been in office for about a year and a half before the term comes up. Clearly, Powell has had run-ins with Donald Trump during the final months of the Trump administration. He's still being criticized by him as wanting to cut rates in order to help Joe Biden. On the Democratic side, we saw the questioning take place in the House 2 days ago, Ash, saying, why don't you take into account the concerns of homeowners, people who want to buy homes? Why don't you cut interest rates? So the pressure is going to be very intense, and I'm not going to believe that he will be able to act in a sense totally dispassionate considering all the pressure around him.
Well,
those are the three components of my answer to you.
And it's such a clear and direct answer. You really took this head on and tackled exactly what you see coming in terms of sequencing. I want to talk a little bit about geopolitics, what's happening in the Red Sea, about the credit issue, about the banking system. But first, because you touched on these issues, I want to take a look at a clip from a show that we did here on Real Vision that addresses some of the issues you just mentioned. This is called What Can Derail the NVIDIA Rally? This is Maggie Lake talking to Eric Johnston, head of equity and derivatives cross asset at Cantor Fitzgerald. Let's take a look.
Yes, so it's an everything rally. So literally everything from bonds to the other end of the spectrum, crypto, gold, stocks, credit is at its tights, absorbing a significant amount of supply year to date. So it's been a buy everything. And I think that one of the factors that could account for that is that there is an expectation, which is certainly our view, that QT is likely going to tail off, that they're going to wind it down, start talking about it possibly or likely in the March meeting, and that they will wind down QT over the course of the next 6 months. And so I think that winding QT to zero, the next step, not right away, but the next step is launching QE. Because ultimately, the reason why they are going to be ending QT is not because they necessarily want to, but because they have to, based on the supply and demand dynamics that are out there in the debt market. And so I think that down the road, the market is also thinking not only they're going to end that, but they're going to have to start buying bonds to monetize the debt.
Once again, from Maggie's conversation with Eric Johnston from Cantor Fitzgerald, Sri, you and Eric share this point about the notion of the Fed being forced to relaunch quantitative easing. Talk a little bit about that. I know you touched on that in your earlier points.
Yeah, I think quantitative easing is in a sense more powerful weapon, Ash, than just cutting interest rates. I think liquidity has a much bigger impact on consumers, on businesses, than even interest rates do. How do we know that? Take a look at what has happened to the recession. A number of us, me inclusive, have been looking for a recession to take place. It is getting repeatedly postponed because of the amount of liquidity that the Fed provided to the consumers over the years, not only after the Lehman collapse, but again, in the last 2 to 3 years, how much liquidity has increased by. Now, quantitative tightening is taking place. But despite that, Ash, the total amount of Fed balance sheet is about 85% higher today than it was at the start of COVID at the beginning of 2020. Think about that. They are supposed to have been doing quantitative tightening, but yet the balance sheet is much larger than it was before. Now, if what they found in September of 2019 was when they had introduced quantitative tightening for 2 years under the chairmanship of Janet Yellen, they ran into a short-term interest rate spike problem in September of 2019, and the Fed had to intervene. They had to put in liquidity on an emergency basis, and that was the end of QT. They ended it, and quantitative easing resumed. We never went back to QT immediately because COVID came, and they decided, if anything, to increase the balance sheet even more. Now they have been doing quantitative tightening for about 15 months, 18 months, and now their pressures are developing. I agree with Eric and what he said fully, Ash, and the reason is Lori Logan, who is the president of the Dallas Fed, and she was the person most responsible for managing the problems as an official of the New York Fed in 2019, with what happened with the short-term money rate spiking problem. She has said recently that quantitative tightening is likely to be slowed down, not eliminated, but slowed down. But if they find out that there is a new banking crisis or a new form of new problem with the commercial real estate situation, I wouldn't be surprised if it is stopped totally and quantitative easing resumes. There's one more aspect to this. Lower interest rates would be absolutely welcomed by President Biden and Secretary Yellen today. It would reduce the cost of debt service from their point of view, and they can turn around and say, see, I told you, debt service is not a problem. The increase in debt is not an issue at all. Our interest costs have actually gone down. And what contributed to it? A reduction in the interest rate. So there are a lot of political influences today which would also argue for quantitative easing to resume and for interest rates to be cut. Will it be? When will it be? Middle of the year is my guess as well. But don't expect it to happen because the Fed wins the war against inflation. That's not the reason.
We're going to take another quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And if you're relatively new to this and you want a visual representation of what Sri is talking about, just type WALCL into your browser and you'll get a look at this chart of the Fed's balance sheet, total assets less eliminations from consolidation. You can see that curve. You can see the quantitative tightening coming in from about, call it about $9 trillion. Down to about $7.5 trillion where we are today. But you can see where we are massively above that $4 trillion pre-pandemic. And by the way, roll the chart back to 2008 or so, look before the last financial crisis, and you'll see we're below $1 trillion, probably close to around $800 billion. If you look at that chart, you'll see that trajectory that Sri just described. You touched on something else, which is what's happening in commercial real estate. Sri, I am not a deep thinker about commercial real estate. I'm not a deep thinker about commercial real estate debt. I don't understand how we can essentially change the entire structure of the U.S. economy. I don't know about you, but I have very few friends who are going into work Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. You know, Real Vision essentially gave up our office space here in Chelsea. Why? Because we're all working from home. We're doing these calls over Zoom. This is the way the world is going. I just don't understand how there cannot be some knock-on effects from that massive shift in the real economy. I mean, it's just, it's baffling to me how this isn't more of an issue.
Absolutely. It is a big issue. And I think we have not seen the end of it, Ash. And I'll tell you why. The problems started actually with COVID and people withdrawing. But let's say if you put the start of COVID as March of 2020, when people realized there was a global pandemic around and stopped going to work, another 1 year, year and a half passed, we came to the end of 2021, when we realized there's a lot of open space in office buildings. But it was still not so much of a problem. It was more isolated. And as 2022, 2023 went by, the problem has gathered much more in importance.
Right.
Every year that goes by, we find more loans are due to the banks. And here again, I think your listeners should be aware that there is a difference between what you pay on your home mortgage, where whatever you borrow, you're going to be paying amortization as well as interest over the life of the loan. Whereas if you get a commercial real estate loan to in order to build an office building, you probably make only interest payments regularly with your principal payment due at maturity. And at the time of maturity, you're unable to pay. And typically when that happens, we have a practice which has come to be called extend and pretend. That means
Yes. The
banks say, I was not paid last quarter. The payments are 3 months or 6 months late, but I believe that I will get paid anyway. So I'm going to value that loan at par. So 6 months go by, 1 year goes by, then you can no longer continue to pretend that you're going to be paid at par. You perhaps the regulators force you to take it down to 90 cents or 80 cents on the dollar. That is when you have to start thinking, you, the banker, have to start thinking about what you're going to do to your portfolio. And that is where these uncertainties are starting to show up. And as far as the real estate developers are concerned, they have twin problems. That banker is knocking at their door, increasing the interest rate they have to pay on a loan they took a few years ago, demanding repayment of the principal. Whereas on the real estate developer side, as you mentioned, Ash, the tenants are going away. They are working from home. They are working with Zoom. They don't need to go back. And even if you need to go back 2 or 3 days a week, your space is probably shared by one or two other people, so they still need less space than when all of you went to work all the time. So that is the crux of the problem. What needs to be happen? I've talked to people and said, how about converting some of the commercial real estate into multifamily homes? I'm told that there is a problem. If you take a Midtown Manhattan building and convert that into residential space, regulations require that all homeowners have windows that they look out. And of course, Yes. You cannot get that in an office building. So we have a lot of adjustments to make.
Whenever I talk to my real estate friends about this, they're like, you finance guys, you think it's like, it's just moving numbers around in a spreadsheet. We're dealing with the real world, plumbing, electrical, window space, right. How you get access to this and that, fire codes. I mean, it's not trivial.
It's not trivial at all. It is a major issue, which is why I'm going back to your original question, Ash. How does it resolve itself? You have a building and you built a building, the face value of it in pick a date, January of 2020 or 2019, it was $100 million. Now I'm going to come in and I'm going to buy it from you. And this has happened actually in San Francisco and New York. So I'm not making up stories. I buy it from you for $40 million rather than the $100 million that you paid for it in 2019. So there is often a 50, 60% discount to the price which prevailed 5 years ago. Mm. And forget about inflation. Nominal value has gone down by 60%. The real value, if anything, has gone down even more. So I think that's the way the adjustment is going to take place. If I buy it at a 60% discount from face value, even if the rent payment to me is less than before, even if only half of the building is occupied, I probably can make money because I didn't pay too much for it. But the ones who did pay a lot of money 5 years ago, they're going to take a hit.
Chair, I want to have you back on to talk about just this for an hour and a half, to talk about all the potential knock-on effects, how that debt gets bundled up, who holds the CMBS, what it means for the banking system. I mean, there's so many questions, but I wanted to touch on something else that you wrote about that I thought was really interesting, which is what's happening right now in the Red Sea. This is a pretty big deal, this idea that ships are diverting to sail around the Cape of Good Hope. That's some 6,000 nautical miles added to shipping journeys. I mean, it's literally driving back and forth from Los Angeles to New York City, a huge amount of distance. I think nautical miles are actually about 1.2% larger than, 1.2x. I mean, it's a huge distance is the bottom line. It's just a massive amount of time, a massive amount of money that goes into this. What does this mean for the global economy? What does it mean for supply chains?
I think somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 to 20% of global merchandise traffic passes through the Red Sea. And the that is actually a short way to come from Asia, from Europe, go through the Red Sea and go to the west, to the United States or to Canada. So it's an easy route. If you have to go around the southern tip of Africa and come around to the United States, it's going to add, it already has added tremendously to the cost.
Yes.
That's one thing. Some cargo ships have braved the issue and they have continued to pass through the Red Sea. And there are attacks coming from Yemen toward the traffic, toward the ships. And that is not going to end. I think it is going to persist. And it has Fitch Ratings put out a report in the last couple of days saying this has lasted much longer than they anticipated even in December. So this is not ending. It is going on. And I think it is going to contribute to inflation. And that is, so I'm not a military expert, so I wouldn't talk about that. Let me just say it adds to the overall cost and it is going to keep contributing to inflation for some time to come.
Yeah, obviously much more to talk about on that as well. But I wanted to take some questions from our viewers, and we've got some really good ones. These are some truly global questions. The first one comes from James Mulholland, who wants to know, does the velocity in the yen move pose threats for the equity markets? What are the risks in the carry trade unwind? Obviously, a sophisticated question there.
Great question on Japan. And here is where I would tackle the Japan issue. The Bank of Japan meeting most recently has given rise to expectations that they would soon increase the interest rate, which has not been increased since 2007. So it's been a long, long time when the interest rates were kept at a low level. The expectation is that they will be raised. And if that happens, then you're going to have the 10-year Japan bond yield also rise along with it. And if that happens, and since Japan is still the major creditor country in the whole world, the biggest creditor country, you're going to see the Japanese withdrawing investments from different parts of the world. And that is going to put upward pressure by itself on the U.S. treasury yield, on the German Bund yield as a result of the Japanese move. So I would tackle it from the point of view of Bank of Japan and the interest rate movements. So my own measure, again, a very quick estimate as to what it is if the Japanese central bank goes full steam along those lines, it would contribute about 0.5% more, fully taken into account with the passage of time in the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield.
Yeah. Here's another question about Japan. This one comes from George Toth, who's interested in finding out about yield curve control. Should I be worried about Japanese YCC, your yield curve control, obviously, and rising rates thereon?
But first of all, I think the second part of the question, I think I answered before.
Yes.
Namely, that you should be concerned about Japanese yields increasing. Let me go to the first part of the person's first question. And that is, YCC, in my opinion, is just an unviable strategy. It doesn't work. And I like to point out that the last time the United States had yield curve control, believe it or not, when was it? It was in the late 1940s, exactly, 1940s, ending in 1951-52, because the U.S. Treasury and the Federal Reserve decided that they would hold the yield on the long bond for the same reason we are talking about today, to limit the government's expenses of interest payments. Of course, the debt was much smaller then, but we still worried about interest payments.
Not only was the debt smaller, but it had accrued, obviously, as a consequence of fighting and winning the Second World War, a very short, time-limited period where the U.S. economy obviously transitioned to the private sector from public sector spending.
Absolutely. That happened, Ash. On top of that, when we were recovering from the Second World War expenses, the Korean War began, and the United States was a part of it. That's what caused yield curve control to come to an end, because the Treasury and the Fed decided that they could not support the yield any longer. They announced that they will not support it, and immediately the yield shot up. And that, I think, is going to happen in the Japanese case as well when the yield curve control is ended, that they are going to have a significant spike up in the 10-year JGB yield, and that's not going to be good for the yields of countries like the Eurozone and for the United States.
Sri, it's wonderful to have you with us where you can share this long-term perspective on markets. You've been doing this a long time, studying this very closely and very thoughtfully.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you one more question because it touches on something that we were discussing earlier about the credit situation, about the banking system here in the United States. It comes to us from one of our regular viewers, Ralph Humphrey. What does Sri think happened at New York Community Bank, an extend and pretend day of reckoning, or something else? Is this specific and idiosyncratic to that particular institution, or could it be something broader?
Ralph, you have two parts to your questions, and let me take up your first part first. I do not believe that it is idiosyncratic. That is what Secretary Yellen, Chairman Powell would like you to believe, because they do not want you to think it's a system-wide problem. But I think it is actually system-wide, because it was caused by the banking problem of March of 2023 happened because the chairman told us that inflation was transitory. So what did you do? The chairman or CEO of Silicon Valley Bank bought 10-year treasuries at 1.9%. The problem is he did the right thing. He believed the chairman. He thought 1.9% was a too high a yield for the 10-year treasury. Chairman tells you that inflation is transitory. That means the 10-year yield is going to go down to 1%. Unfortunately, the chairman was totally wrong. Inflation spiked up and the yields went up as well, and the bank lost out. So that's where the systemic element comes in. It is not Silicon Valley Bank alone that was affected by it. It's not just New York Community Bank alone that was affected by it. You have the whole systemic banks which came down as a result of it. The second part to your question is what happened in New York Community Banks as a particularly the big exposure to rent-controlled apartments in New York City. This is the problem. When you play with the competitive system, and you artificially introduce controls into what people are doing, that affects thinking. It creates, again, disturbances, dislocations, which the bureaucrats are simply not able to divine. And that was the second reason why it happened. I'm actually going to extend it, Ralph, and go to a third part to the answer. And that's the following, that if you have the Fed right now starting to increase, if you're thinking about cutting interest rates but maintaining it at a high level, you have all of the smaller institutions which become bigger institutions with acquisitions. That was the case with New York Community Bank, which went from a small bank to a medium-sized bank when it crossed the $100 billion deposit threshold. Now, how many banks are there less than $100 billion which are not being regulated so closely as those with more than $100 billion? And could you have 20, 25 banks in trouble, but they don't come up to the surface because they don't meet the $100 billion criteria?
Right. Sri.
You see where? Go ahead.
I want, I want to have you back for 4 one-hour shows on Real Vision. The banking system, credit markets, geopolitics, and monetary policy.
Thank you. I'm happy to do it. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Ash.
Well, until then, final thoughts, key takeaways that you'd like to leave our viewers and our listeners with today.
The key part, I would say, is be cautious and simply do not believe the Fed. Prepare yourself for an interest rate cut. Prepare yourself for some form of a credit event to take place. And in that context, keep a significant chunk, I think, of the portfolio to be inclusive in high-grade fixed income securities, like 10-year treasuries. Even if the Bank of Japan increases returns yields and you have the 10-year yield rise in the United States, if you have a 2 to 5 year horizon, that should still serve you well, even if you have a loss in the short term. That's where I would leave your listeners, Ash.
Sri, I always appreciate that you're always willing to take a stand, take the questions head on, and take a position. Dr. Sri Kumar, Sri Kumar, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ash.
And thanks to everyone for watching and for listening. Real Vision Daily Briefing. We'll be back next week, same time, same place. See you then. Have a great weekend, everybody.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. At Real Vision, we arm you with the expert knowledge, time-efficient tools, and a powerful network to help you succeed on your financial journey. Get a taste of financial freedom with our free offer at realvision.com/free.